On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we will be talking all things Roky Sasaki, the 23-year-old Japanese pitching phenom. Seems to be coming over stateside at some point this winter, so we'll tell you everything you need to know about the hard-throwing hurler, and we'll chat with Yuri Karasawa, an NPB expert, to lay out the Sasaki saga. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who knows that the offseason truly begins when you find yourself watching football on a Sunday morning. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and yes, I actively chose to flip on the Carolina Panthers versus the New York Giants in Munich, Germany today for 3 minutes, and that's how my offseason is going.
I'm sorry to hear that. I hope you had a good time watching whatever that was. I'm sure you didn't, but I appreciate the honesty. As we are recording this late on Sunday evening, we just finished recording a wonderful interview with special guest Yuri Karasawa. This guy knows his stuff. Roky Sasaki was posted, or is going to be posted, by the Chiba Marines, and there is nobody I would rather talk to about Japanese baseball than the man behind Yaku Cosmopolitan, one of my favorite baseball internet entities. So we're going to have Yuri on a little bit later to give us the full background of Mr. Sasaki. But before we get to Yuri, we are going to kind of set the stage here, because, listen, if you're listening to this, you say, hey, Jake and Jordan, you guys talked about Sasaki last week, and you said, hold your horses, slow your roll, this guy's not coming over anytime soon. And then I woke up on Saturday morning and I was like, oh, welp, that is not the case.
Now we're going to tell you to let go of your horses and speed up your roll, because Sasaki is going to be coming over. Now let's start from square one. Who is Roky Sasaki? Well, very simply, the second it was announced that he will be posted and will almost certainly play in MLB next year, we put him at number two on our top 50 free agent list, behind only Juan Soto. That means we have him above Corbin Burns, Max Fried, Blake Snell, all these other players who have, and pitchers who have been in the big leagues for a long time and had a ton of success. Blake Snell has won 2 Cy Young Awards, okay? And we have Roky Sasaki ahead of him. That should convey to you, hopefully, how skilled people think this guy is. So that is why he matters, why he is a big deal, and why he is going to dominate the majority of this podcast.
And while his age is very relevant to the unique free agency that he is about to, you know, endeavor into, it is also part of why he will be so highly sought after. Now, because of the situation as we are about to describe, he will not be able to command a record-setting contract the way his countryman Yoshinobu Yamamoto was able to last year, when a lot of the beginning of that conversations was not just about how talented he was, but what did we always say? He's 25! He's 25! You do not get access to free agents like this in the baseball universe. It just does not happen. And now we are talking about someone who just turned 23. And it's relevant when we talk about Juan Soto, right? He just turned 26. How much of his prime are we going to be getting? That is also part of what makes Sasaki so special. However, part of the reason why we were skeptical that this was definitely going to happen is because the choice for Sasaki to be posted, as he has requested his NPB team, the Chiba Lotte Marines, to do, that is a decision that will cost him possibly hundreds of million dollars, at least in the short term. As we know, Shohei Ohtani made this same decision after the 2017 season, which is, if I am going to leave Japan before I turn 25 and have completed 6 years in the league, that means I will only be able to sign a minor league contract, and I will be subject to the international bonus restrictions that teams put on international players in when they are considered amateurs, right? They are not considered full pro players who have played a certain number of years in a foreign pro league and are at least 25 years old. That is the decision Shohei Ohtani made in 2017, and because of that, if you recall, it was not about the highest bidder. It was not about who could give him the most money. Yes, there is some discrepancy between how much money teams can give him within the international bonus pool, but it is not about hundreds of millions of dollars. It is about where he wants to go. And once again, Roki Sasaki has given us a scenario like this where it is not about who can afford him. It is about where he wants to play. And that is why this is going to be one of, I mean, basically the co-headline of the offseason alongside Juan Soto.
And the precedent of the Ohtani situation is relevant here, because if we remember that time in our lives where it felt like everyone had a chance to get Ohtani, that is so rare, because in free agency, there are fan bases right now rooting for competitive teams who know in their heart of hearts that they will not land Juan Soto, right?
Most of these top guys, right?
Or most of these top guys.
Yeah.
Now, in theory, every team can afford, quotes, what that means, Roki Sasaki. They can pay him the 3-point-whatever-million-dollar bonus he's going to end up getting, which is peanuts compared to what he would have gotten had he waited for himself to age out of the international bonus pool restrictions, and he could have commanded something probably in the ballpark of what Yoshinobu Yamamoto got, which was 12 years, $325 million. I would wait 2 years, personally. Let me say this. The narrative about Sasaki and what it was with Ohtani was like, respect to this guy. He just wants to challenge himself amongst the best. And like, money is not happiness, but that's a lot of money. And if it was me, I think I would wait. And maybe that's why I'm not a professional athlete. But now, that's my 2 cents.
Ohtani ended up, not only did Ohtani decide, I will wait to get my payday. Once he got to his payday, he then said again, I will wait, by deferring whatever giant percentage of it far down the road. Now, in Sasaki's case, he wants to get to MLB as soon as possible. And now, if he does that, he's going to be a major league free agent at age, whatever, 28, 29, and maybe he's one of the best pitchers in the world and all those things. Now, so many things can happen over the next 6 years, let alone the next 6 months. Of course, health, all these things, right, of course. The point is, this is quite the decision to make. Full stop. This is, regardless of all the endorsement money he's going to make, and he's still about to make a couple million dollars, is more money than a lot of us can ever comprehend. This is undeniably a massive choice that he is making, and that is, we should not just skip past that, right? That says a lot about him and what his goals are and what his priorities are and what he cares about.
Now, the one difference between Sasaki and Ohtani, in terms of where he's going to go, I think there's a lot less hope for the small market teams. Because when we did the Ohtani thing, like, we knew he was getting sit-down meetings with the Pirates, remember?
Yes.
Like, he was talking to everybody.
Yes.
And the overwhelming sense with Sasaki is that that's not going to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the very early stages of this. When he is going to get posted is still to be determined and will have some sort of impact on it as for when he is going to be signing and exactly how much he is going to be getting in terms of the bonus, because if he's posted before December 15th, he would be a part of this year's international bonus class. If he gets posted after that, he'll be a part of next year's international bonus class, which opens on January 15th. That will impact exactly how much money teams have to give them. But here is what's more important as we reflect back, because I did want to bring up the Ohtani part of this, right? What was the other thing we were talking about all the time with Shohei Ohtani when he was coming over? Obviously.
Well, he needed to play for a National League or an American League team because yes. He had to hit.
Yes. Is or just in general, he wanted to play both ways. And that was a big part of the conversation. So we don't have to worry about that anymore. However, we do seem to be, as things stand, narrowing in a big way where we are expecting him to, you know, keep his focus on in terms of the teams that are really going to be in the mix. Now, because they will not be precluded from affording him, that doesn't mean that all 30 teams should not be calling, you know, Joel Wolf of Wasserman, who has represented most of the Japanese stars that have come over, including Yoshinobu Yamamoto and Senga and Darvish, a lot of these guys, his representation. Everyone should still be calling. Like, there's really no excuse not to call and just be like, is there something we're missing? Does Rogi want to play on the East Coast? Does he want to, you know, play in a spring training complex in Florida? Like, is there something? Like, you need to make those phone calls. That has to happen.
He watched the 2024 MLB season and fell in love with the way the American League Central plays baseball and just
like
that has a desire to be there. Yes. You don't know. You don't know. Every team's got to pick up the phone.
Every team has to do that. However, unlike with Ohtani, which to your point, that is true. When they did it, when CAA and Nesbitt were doing it, they were very much doing like, okay, we want everybody's pitch, and then we will narrow it down to a list of seven finalists, and then we will go from there. Now, that whole process took about a week. He was posted on December 1st, and December 7th or 8th, he was on the Angels. And by the way, let's recall too, the Angels was shocking. It was a stunning outcome, no matter what. Oh, American League, okay, Los Angeles. No, everyone was stunned by that. So let's not forget that. Especially as we now all assume he's going to end up with the Dodgers or perhaps the Padres. But that is, as we look forward into what this is going to look like, because obviously when we talk about free agents, we talk about where is this guy going to go. As with Juan Soto, where we're assuming Yankees versus Mets, the sense right now is Dodgers or Padres. Now, why are those the two teams that we're talking about? We're going to get into this a little bit more specifically later with Yuri, but it's not that hard to explain. The first part is that the Dodgers, especially in this first international bonus period, do have the most money to offer him if he wants to sign as soon as possible. And they have that Ohtani and Yamamoto guy. But you know why else you would sign with the Dodgers? The reason why really most people will sign with the Dodgers. The reason why Teoscar Hernandez wanted to sign with the Dodgers. Because players play well there and they win.
They're good.
They're good. Seems fun to play for the Dodgers. That would have been true if Ohtani and Yamamoto were not on the team. Can we all admit that? Can we all recognize that if Ohtani and Yamamoto did not exist, we would probably be talking about the Dodgers as a really good place for Rogi Sasaki to sign? I think we would be doing that. I think we would. I think we would be saying that. So let's not forget that, right? However, the Padres represent a very interesting character in this because, I mean, obviously they are the Dodgers' biggest rival. And obviously they are a team that we just watched have an incredible season, came up just short. And also a team that we don't necessarily expect to be spending big this winter in the way that they have in the past because of where their status of their kind of finances are. However, this is still a team we expect to be active and relevant. And this is exactly the kind of player that you can imagine AJ Preller wanting to get. And you don't have to take it from me. Take it from AJ Preller himself. Because one of the more stunning bits of honesty we have seen, even by AJ Preller standards in recent years, was AJ Preller speaking at the celebration of life for Peter Seidler, who passed away, of course, last offseason. And when he spoke at Petco Park, talking in reverence of Peter Seidler, of course, as many people did and have since, he said something during that ceremony that was not insignificant. He said, talking about how excited Peter Seidler was for the future, talking about players in the future who will be a part of the Padres. He references Ethan Salas, their top catching prospect, of course. He's one of the top prospects in the sport. Ethan said, loves talking about Ethan Salas. Or a Rogi Sasaki, AJ Preller just said during the ceremony, said, or a Rogi Sasaki, players, you know, pursuing as part of the Padres. That does not feel like an accident. Does that mean Rogi Sasaki is 100% going to sign with the Padres? No, but we sure know that they are going to be trying, and we sure know that AJ Preller felt comfortable enough to say that publicly for whatever reason. And that presents a very fascinating dynamic just between these two teams alone, let alone the possibility that there is a chance that someone else could convince him to go there because they can't afford it.
Now, beyond those two, it's pointless to talk about quote-unquote fit because every team could use a 23-year-old starting pitcher who throws 98 and just had some of the greatest seasons on a rate basis in Japanese baseball history. Like, you could use that, and like the White Sox could use that, and Jordan and I could use that on like a rec league men's team. Okay. So fit doesn't really fit specifically with this guy. Last thing I want to say before we kick it to Yuri and before that take a break, it's like, what type of pitcher is he? Right? When you go and you watch Roky Sasaki, the two names that come to mind for me from a stylistic perspective are Skeens and DeGrom. Now, Skeens, I think, is relevant because Sasaki's arrival in the pro top level league in Japan and being dominant immediately is a similar dynamic to what we had with Skeens this year, where Skeens showed up and it was clear within the first seven starts he made that this was one of the best pitchers we had. And Sasaki did a very similar thing over in Japan. And then DeGrom is the comp, and Yuri will make this comp in a second, because he hasn't proven the bulk. He has not thrown more than 120 innings, I believe, in a season during his time in MPB. Now, that doesn't mean he
130, I think, is his max. Yep.
129.1. So, like, that doesn't mean he can't or he won't. It just means that the bulk there isn't at the same level as some of the other pitchers who have come over. I just think that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about DeGrom is he did do it for multiple seasons. It's just that he somehow kept getting better. And then when he got to the level in 2021, that's when he started breaking down. But that's all. It's so ridiculous because DeGrom, this is a total tangent, but DeGrom had already won multiple Cy Youngs, and then he somehow was getting even better to the point where we wanted more and more and more and more and more, and that's when he started breaking down. So it's not like we didn't see it, but it's kind of how we've talked about DeGrom in this stage of his career.
All right. Enough about us talking about a player who we have not seen throw many pitches live and any pitches in person. We'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll do that. We will simply do that.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now very excited to be joined by a very, very special guest. His name is Yuri Kawasawa. He is also known better by those who spend time on the baseball internet as Yaku Cosmopolitan. Yuri, welcome to Baseball Barbacast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. I've been following your guys' work for a long time. And yeah, I'm really excited to be here talking about Japanese players coming to MLB this offseason.
So Yuri, before we get to all of the Sasaki context that I think you are especially equipped to provide us, why don't you give us a little bit of background of how you ended up being one of the first people I thought of when I said, we have to have this guy on to talk about this Sasaki situation. So give a little bit of background of why you are so into MPB and how you've kind of got to the point where you are today.
Yeah, of course. So, my name is Yuri Kawasawa, but I'm half Japanese. I grew up in the U.S., but I do live in Japan now, actually in Chiba, the local team here that we're talking about, of course, with Roky Sasaki. And in 2020, during the pandemic, I saw a tweet from Foolish Bailey saying that, you know, like people talking about baseball on the internet, it's kind of oversaturated. But if you want to talk KBO or MPB in English, there might be a market for that. And I said, you know what? As a Japanese American, I've been following the MPB for a long time, and maybe I could fill this role. And so I started out, you know, very slowly on YouTube, and then I ended up growing out to like Twitter and X. But my main goal really is to be able to bridge that gap, because there's a language barrier, obviously, but I think there's definitely an interest in the U.S. for Japanese baseball. And I just want more people to be able to experience like the great product that is MPB and learn about a lot of these players before they actually end up going to MLB.
And that is part of the reason why when Jordan and I were talking about building an episode around Roky Sasaki, like we have never seen Roky Sasaki play. We have never studied Roky Sasaki. In our minds, he is a brilliant pitcher, but he is also a question mark. And so for us to come on a show and tell our listeners definitive things about this person that we know very little about felt very empty. You, however, have been following and thinking about this player for years. And so I want to begin there. When did Roki Sasaki first pop onto your radar as someone who tracks NPB, like, way more than any other, not any other, but most other English speakers on the baseball internet space?
Yeah, so 2019 is the year he's drafted, and basically the summer leading up to the draft, because the NPB draft is in October at the end of the season, you know, everyone's talking about Roki Sasaki. He's this 17-year-old coming out of a high school in Iwate up in the north, throwing 100 miles per hour, which is obviously extremely rare in Japan, basically the first to do it since Shohei Ohtani. You can stick a Shintaro Fujinami in there too, but the point is, a Japanese prospect throwing 100 miles per hour is almost unheard of. There's also Yasunobu Okugawa, who was another top pitching prospect at the time, but those were basically the two big names going into the draft. And then the way the MPB draft works, it's a nomination and lottery system. So it's not like your standard MLB draft where the worst team gets the first overall pick. If you want the player, you nominate him and then you draw cards to see who gets the player. And so four of the 12 MPB teams went for Roki Sasaki. The Chibolote Marines were one of them, and they were lucky enough to win the lottery. And so he enters the league. Obviously, you have the COVID shortened 2020 season immediately. So he didn't pitch at all in 2020, but he ends up having his rookie year in 2021. And, you know, he was as advertised, but really after that is when he really breaks out and blew everybody away. And so I'm sure we'll get into that more later. But yeah, like, he's really been on everyone's radar since he was a teenager.
I'm curious that how common is it? I know that with players like Ohtani and some of the best prospects, obviously here domestically, high school players generally go through the minor leagues, right? And the very few of the best high school players get to the major leagues immediately. Now, I know because of COVID, it was a little bit of a delay. And I know that there is a minor league system in Japan. But I'm curious, how unique is it for a pitcher that young to have success that quickly at the highest level of Japanese baseball?
Yeah, so a lot of the very, very best prospects, like a Yu Darvish or a Masahiro Tanaka, do debut very quickly at 18 even. But for somebody to dominate as much as Sasaki did at 19 is really special. And again, with the way the MLB, the MPB farm system works, definitely a lot of high schoolers will spend the first 2-3 years of their career honing their skills there. Maybe they get a cup of coffee at the top MPB level. But Sasaki was talent-wise, like, already there with the best of the best from year one. And that's really what made him so special. It wasn't just the fact that he could throw 100 miles per hour. His command was also, like, on point. And he was doing it with just two pitches, the fastball and the splitter. And so in terms of just his overwhelming ability, it's just like Roki Sasaki was the real deal. And he continued to prove that year after year, although he had some durability issues. And that's really what's been keeping him from truly becoming like the consensus, like, oh, this is the number one pitcher in MPB from a lot of Japanese fans' perspective. It's just the fact that he hasn't been able to stay healthy. But talent-wise, I mean, you know, the numbers speak for themselves.
I'm curious, the one other thing I want to ask about him and early in his career and just kind of how he has ascended. And you mentioned that the durability, and I want to get to some of that, especially with this last season that he just had in 2024, because I think that that's an important piece of data that we need to address. But I'm also curious how he has... Where is his popularity level? Where is his kind of status level within the league? Is it just he is this singular talent? He's throwing harder than everybody else. He's been famous since high school. Is he considered widely the best pitcher in Japan? Or is it just about that durability thing? And then where does his team fall into this? I don't know much about the Marine success, and you don't have to give us the full breakdown of that, but has he been pitching on a team that's been relevant? Because I know so many of these other stars that we've had coming over, we hear about them, you know, winning the Japan series and pitching on one of these best teams that we've, you know, in Japan. Has that been the case for Sasaki, or has he been kind of this star on a team that maybe isn't as relevant as some of the other best teams in the league?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think Sasaki, his popularity isn't quite as high as the average MLB fan would expect, but he's still very marketable, obviously. And I think it definitely helped that he was a star for Japan at the World Baseball Classic. If he didn't have the World Baseball Classic, then it could be, you know, a completely different story we're talking about. But he has that success at the national level, international level. And then as far as the team situation goes, the Lotte Marines, they are a smaller market team than, say, like the Yomiuri Giants or the SoftBank Hawks. And so he doesn't really have that same supporting cast around him that's been able to push him over the top in terms of team success. Now, I would say that without him, despite the fact that he hasn't been able to stay healthy and pitch in the rotation all year, once in his career at this point, the Marines probably don't make the playoffs in each of the last 2 years without him, because they just snuck in towards the end of the season in each of the last 2 years. So Sasaki's definitely been a major contributor in that sense. Personality-wise, though, he is quite a bit shy and kind of reserved. He's not like this over-the-top guy that really tries to put his face out there. And so I think there's a little bit of a disconnect there in terms of, like, you know, he's this superstar presence, but the personality doesn't really match that. And so, yeah, he's definitely a very popular player. But even from among his own fan base, I don't think he's the most popular player, even on his own team.
Interesting. So, like, if we're talking about baseball players on billboards, right? It's like, I was in Japan in 2020, right before COVID, and it's like Otani, enormous gap, everybody else. Where would you say Sasaki is right now in terms of his national visibility?
Yeah, I would say he's probably somewhere in the top five, at least, just based on the fact that everyone who at least casually follows baseball knows who Roki Sasaki is. He does a lot of advertisements locally in Chiba. And obviously, if you're a fan of the national team, which basically everyone is in Japan with how big the WBC is, Sasaki is an enormous core player. But is he on the level of Otani? Is he on the level of Darvish? No. And is he even on the level of, like, Shota Imanaga, who's, you know, having a lot of success in MLB? I would say he's probably somewhere close to that range. But obviously, in terms of the potential to be more and more marketable, depending on where he lands in MLB, that's very much high.
So now I want to kind of get into how we got here and particularly zoom in on the season that he just had, because if you look at Sasaki's statistics, 2023 is like outrageous. And I know he had the 19 strikeout perfect game was, I believe, in 2022, and that's when he threw the most innings. But on a rate basis, what he did in 2023, though it was just in 15 starts, it has big 2021 Jacob DeGrom energy, is really the,
oh, yeah.
is really the comp that I would put on it, where just the numbers are so absurd, except you just have to put the qualifier in that it was only, you know, 90 or so innings. But we're talking about, you know, almost nearly a 40% strikeout rate, an ERA under two. And just, I love that he had the highest strikeout rate in the league and the highest ground ball rate in the league. Like, just things that you just can't even totally wrap your mind around. Of course, he's averaging 99 miles an hour in the fastball. So that's obviously amazing. He's 21. This year was not quite the same. And I want to kind of zoom in on that as to what this season was like for him. Because while there is still rightful, you know, justified, incredible excitement about him, this season was not quite as good. It was still very good. His ERA was still very low, and he still struck out a bunch of guys. But the velocity was a little bit lower. He dealt with some injuries. So can you talk a little bit about how his, regardless of the context with MLB, how his season was received this year and the kind of the ups and downs of it?
Yeah, so early in the year, I think many people thought this could very well be his last season. And so the Lotte Marines clearly weren't holding back in terms of the pitch counts. In previous years, they were so heavily load managing him, rarely going over 100 pitches, which MPB starters are almost universally expected to throw over 100 pitches a start. This year, though, from the get-go, he's throwing 110, 120 pitches each start. And his average velocity was down. And so the confusing thing was, like, is he hurt? Is he, you know, fatigued? Is he unable to reach those previous heights of 100, 101 miles per hour? Or is he doing this to, quote unquote, save his bullets? Is he trying to pace himself better for the full season? Is he even preparing for MLB ahead of time and not trying to overexert himself, which probably isn't the best look for himself and the team. But the point is, like, early in the season, he's chugging along. He's not quite at that ridiculously elite level that we had seen in 2023, but coming off an injury at the end of 2023, that's understandable. And he was eating a lot of innings. He was still pitching incredibly well. Then he has this 2-month-long injury from June to the beginning of August with what we now know is probably shoulder fatigue. And he comes back in early August. His command is kind of all over the place. Didn't really look like himself. But down the stretch in September, as the team is making a playoff push, we begin to see, like, the real deal again. Is he up to 99, 100? Not quite. But he's, you know, 97, 98 on the fastball. He's getting way more comfortable with that slider to go along with the nasty split finger. And he looks like, once again, the complete package. Like, this guy is the number one or number two pitcher in MPB. He pitches very well in the postseason as well. In the wild card series for Lotte, he has 8 shutout innings. He actually hasn't given up a single run in his postseason career to this point. Across 3 starts. So he's been able to prove that in the biggest games, he's able to pitch well. But the Marines are eliminated despite his best efforts. And so that basically does it for his MPB career, a very premature end to it. A lot of people were wanting more, but it's like you're asking for the encore and you're not getting it. And so it's very much a sad feeling that a lot of their fans have. But that's basically how the season went. It wasn't quite as elite as we've seen in the past. But even him being at only 80% is still, you know, incredible numbers. And I think that's very clear in the fact that his strikeout rate minus walk rate for his career is better than Ohtani or Yamamoto's career high. You know, it's 27% K minus BB percent. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And so Roki Sasaki, the floor with him is so high, and the ceiling is obviously out of this world.
So something I'm very interested in is the statement that Chiba Lotte posted to Twitter when it was announced that he was going to be posted, right? And this is the comment. I'm just going to read part of the quote from Sasaki that's on this post. A post, by the way, that has 24.6 million views, which, you know, we can always trust everything we read on X. Sasaki says, quote, "Since I joined my team, the team has been listening to my thoughts about my future challenge in the MLB. I'm very grateful to my team for officially allowing me to post now. There were many things that did not go well during my 5 years with the Marines, but I was always supported by my teammates, staff, front office, and fans." Is that I literally just clicked translate, which I understand is lazy, but is that generally the correct translation of what it says?
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of MLB fans see that and they're like, what do you mean? You threw 17 consecutive perfect innings. You're, you know, posting incredible numbers every single season, like breaking, you know, strikeout records. You have 13 consecutive strikeouts in that 19 strikeout perfect game, by the way. So it's like, what do you mean? Right. But I think with Roki Sasaki, the dilemma that he's faced is the fact that he wasn't able to pitch a full season with the Lotte Marines. And we'll get into it with maybe what happened behind the scenes with the posting. But I think when he initially signs up for basically being there for 5 years, he's going to get a premature posting to MLB. Both him and the team are hoping that he can, you know, eat a lot of innings. He can be that true ace in the rotation for many, many years in this short window, win now, and get everything out of it in terms of the team's success. The team, again, made the playoffs a number of times, but they didn't get over that hump. And when it comes to his wins, which, you know, MPB teams very much still value how many wins you have, it was only this year that he actually got to double digit wins. And so this is the thing that he basically has to say to appease both the team and the fans, like, hey, I, you know, even though him for Sasaki for 90 innings is better than almost any other pitcher over 150, 160 innings. It's like he wasn't able to pitch a qualified season. He couldn't get to that 143 inning mark that gets you all those awards and titles. And so I think that's really what he's going to be leaving with regretting, is the fact that he couldn't finish a season.
That's interesting, because for Ohtani, who is the obvious comparison here just because of the decision to be posted before you are maximizing your value, right? On like getting to the number of years played. Ohtani won the title and basically accomplished everything you could imagine him accomplishing in the NPB. That is not the case with Sasaki. And I think that's something that's important for MLB fans to understand is like, yes, the success that he has had is outrageous and unbelievable. But what we're talking about here is still potential. I mean, this guy turned 23 last week. So we are not getting necessarily like a finished product as a pitcher that's going to come over here. We're getting someone who still has a lot of work to do, but is still really talented right now. My last question for you is kind of very simple, which is why was he posted? If you know anything about the story, and we talked a little bit about it before we had you on, the team from the outside was not incentivized to post Sasaki because if they could have waited a number of years, they could have kind of reaped a much bigger reward from his talents on the open market because the posting fee that they would have been paid by an MLB team, that number likely would have been significantly higher. And from Sasaki's point of view, I mean, he could have just sat on his butt, really. Like, he could have not thrown a baseball for 2 years until it was time for him to be posted, and he probably would have gotten a higher dollar figure than what he will end up getting. So the team's not incentivized, and he, from a financial perspective, is not incentivized. So why is he almost certainly going to be posted?
Yeah, that's the big question, right? Because the obvious comparison is Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who gets posted a couple of months after he turns 25. What did he make? $325 million. His team, Oryx, gets $50 million in the posting fee. Everyone's happy. So why doesn't Sasaki just wait the 2 years and, you know, everyone can go home happy? It just seems like this has been his desire from the get-go because he had MLB interest, both in terms of scouts watching him, but both, you know, him wanting to play overseas since he was a teenager. And so the team would like to present this as a case of, hey, we're doing this out of the goodness of our hearts to let him follow his dreams. But as journalist Jim Allen has written about extensively, the most likely scenario is that Sasaki and his agent were able to get a clause built into his contract when he was first drafted. The reason being, the leverage is completely on the side of the player at the time of the draft. You know, in later years, an arbitration process, especially in MPB with the players union being so weak, the leverage is on the team side. But Sasaki, when he's drafted in 2019, can effectively tell the team, hey, unless you agree to post me early, I'm just not going to join your team. I'm going to wait, sit out a year, re-enter the draft the next year, and you know, go to a team that will actually agree to this. Or maybe I'll just take my talents to the U.S., play, you know, college ball, sign a minor league deal right away. The team effectively gets pushed into a corner there where they have to choose, like, okay, do we agree to get him for, you know, a shortened period of time, only 5 years or so, but we're going to be able to have this amazing raw talent to see if we can win now. Or do we, like, stick to our principles and say, hey, you can't really bully us into doing this, but he's not going to join your team at that point. So that's likely what happened. We're never going to know the actual details of the contract, unfortunately, but that seems to be the case, is that the Lotte Marines, they had their hand forced in terms of Roki Sasaki had asked for an early posting when he first joined the team, and they are now honoring that agreement. But yeah, it's like with Roki Sasaki's time in MPB, it's going to go down in very, you know, complicated terms in the history books, I feel like, because on the one hand, we witnessed absolute greatness. Some of the in terms of the peak, maybe the best we've ever seen. But there's so much more that we could have seen. And we got robbed of, you know, a 25 start sample size last year had he not been heard of, like, you know, a 1.5 ERA with, you know, 250 strikeouts. It's just like the talent that we could have seen, the level we could have seen, you know, we got a taste of it, but people are going to be left wanting more.
It's like Jacob deGrom's entire career.
Yeah, well, and absolutely. Especially when you consider, as you mentioned, you know, Chiba, you know, not getting to I believe they didn't make it to the Japan Series or have that championship in the way that Yamamoto won and Otani won and some of these other stars did. The last question that I really have for you is spinning this forward, because obviously now that it seems like he'll be heading over this winter, there's the question of, okay, so where's he going to go? And while I'm not expecting you to know the answer for that, I am curious about the perception in Japan about what is likely or what he is expected to prioritize. Because of the situation, we know that money is, I mean, maybe it is still a factor. And, you know, Jake and I will talk about the specific machinations of, okay, one team could offer him $2 million and one team can offer him $5 million, all that, whatever. We know that because he is foregoing likely hundreds of millions, that is not the priority. It is so easy for everybody over here to be like, well, clearly he's going to go with the Dodgers, not just because of Otani Yamamoto, but because there is a lot of other reasons to go to the Dodgers beyond Otani and Yamamoto that I think we all have to accept. However, the Padres seem to be an interesting character in this. We're going to, of course, be speculating about this all winter long until we know. But from your perspective and from the Japanese coverage in Tokyo and back home, what is the general, maybe favor? Like, how are they handicapping it compared to over here where everyone's just throwing their hands up and saying, oh, it's probably the Dodgers?
Yeah, I think in Japan, there's definitely at least some feeling that the Padres are on the table, especially because, you know, he's so tight with Yu Darvish. Yu Darvish is like a mentor to him. Others will point out, like, isn't Shohei Ohtani also like a mentor to him? But I feel like Darvish really functions as a second pitching coach. He does that in San Diego, and he definitely did that for Samurai Japan. Darvish was the one that really helped him develop that slider of his further. And so I think a lot of Japanese media is just assuming it's going to be, you know, does he join forces with the already existing super team that is the Dodgers? You know, you have Yamamoto, Ohtani, Sasaki. A lot of Japanese fans would definitely really enjoy that. You know, a lot of the casual fan base certainly would. But I also do think that from a perception perspective of like the Chibolote Marines, you know, already I think the fan base is fairly split on their feelings on Sasaki. A lot of people are very unhappy with him. Others are saying, you know, this is your dream. Just, you know, show us what you can do overseas and make us proud. But I think if he does join the Dodgers, a lot of Lotte fans are going to be, you know, quite disappointed at that, being like, you kind of took the easy path. Does he care about that? I'm not sure. And when we talk about money, yeah, it matters only to the extent that, like, this season, his contract in MPB, he was only making like $500,000-$600,000. And so even a small, you know, minor league deal that he lands with the international bonus pool money, that's still more than he was making here. But obviously, when you're passing up on hundreds of millions in that he could have got in 2026, 2027, money's not the main motivating factor. I really think he's going to go to a place where he feels most comfortable with the city and with the surrounding cast and the environment. And so a lot of people will throw around, like, obviously, the East Coast teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox. But I think that would be a huge shock to most people if he takes that route. I really think Roki Sasaki is doing this because he wants to play in MLB early. And if he wants to play in MLB early, he wants to be able to, you know, be with people that he's comfortable with, be with people that he knows, and really further elevate his game. He wants to become the best pitcher in the world. And so Los Angeles or San Diego seem like the obvious destination. I will point out Darvish had even posted a petition last year trying to get the Marines to post him early. And so it's like, Darvish has been really disappointed that a lot of Japanese players are picking Ohtani over him, which is understandable, but we'll see what happens. I definitely think for the, you know, the health of the rivalry, it would be cool if it's like Darvish and Sasaki and Yuki Matsui against Ohtani and Yamamoto. But, you know, it would be great from a marketing perspective if he's on the Dodgers as well.
Dude, this just makes me feel ancient. Roki Sasaki was 9 years old when Yu Darvish threw his final pitch for the Fighters in NPB in 2011. So I remember when Ohtani came over, there were a lot of conversations about, oh, he grew up watching Darvish. Like, Sasaki literally grew up watching Darvish, right? In a way that he did not see him, like, throw a pitch when Sasaki was in high school. Like, he was a child watching Yu Darvish. So I can imagine the opportunity to play alongside him holds a lot of sway.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is worth pointing out that, you know, he lost his father and his grandfather in the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami. You know, he had a really tough childhood growing up. And so nobody's really in a position to speculate where this guy's head is at. You know, he's had a really tough childhood already. He's gotten through so much to get to this point. And so this is just something that he's wanted to do for a long time. And I think, you know, as much as this sets a really dangerous precedent for MPB in terms of, you know, being poached by MLB, and there's a lot of implications that, you know, we don't have to get into, but I do think that we were very blessed, those of us in Japan, to be able to watch Roki for even 5 years, because you're seeing with guys like Rintaro Sasaki, Shotaro Mori, a lot of them are just skipping MPB altogether. They're going straight to U.S. college or signing a minor league deal. And that is the absolute worst case scenario for fans in Japan, not being able to watch, you know, their domestic talent at the highest level at all. And so I think Roki Sasaki, for me, like having started my presence on YouTube and Twitter covering baseball, Japanese baseball, around the time that he debuted, it was like a blessing for me to be able to cover him. And yeah, I wish him the best. I wish I could have seen him a few more years in MPB, but it is what it is.
Well said, Yuri. You have been an incredible resource as someone who has followed your work for several years. I cannot recommend it enough. Cannot recommend the YouTube, cannot recommend subscribing on Patreon. Everything that he makes is just an incredible resource and has helped me understand Japanese baseball so much more. And I know that that will continue to be the case. Yuri, thanks so much for joining us. And I have a feeling we will be having you on again soon at some point. So thanks so much for your time.
All right. Thank you guys so much. And yeah, enjoy the off season. It's going to be a crazy one.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintzberg and Schusterman. Enough about Roki Sasaki. Roki this, Sasaki that. Don't the Miami Marlins have a new manager, Jake and Jordan? Yes. Yes, they do. We're going to talk about all that and a lot more on this edition of Turbo Mode, where we throw things into fifth gear, put our pedal to the metal, and fly through anything relevant going on in baseball.
Have we considered that Sasaki's interest in the Dodgers is actually an interest in first base coach Clayton McCullough? Because if that's the case, then the Marlins are going to be in this thing. Not only that, also, Roki Sasaki, of course, pitched at Lone Depot Park during the World Baseball Classic. If he had a great time there, maybe he'll say, I'm taking my talents to South Beach. Probably not. But the Marlins do finally have a manager. His name is Clayton McCullough. He has been on the Dodgers Major League coaching staff since 2021, I believe. He's been with the Dodgers as an organization for much longer than that. And I would say that Clayton McCullough falls into the bucket, which we've certainly seen, you know, the categories of hires in recent years kind of fall into a few different buckets, right? I'm going to super simplify it and put it into three, right? There's former player who we're just going to throw into the dugout as soon as possible. Former big leaguer, right? There's legend, come save our team, right? Dusty, Bochy, Tony La Russa. Whoops, that didn't work out. And then there's just the group of like baseball lifer. Oh, actually, maybe this is two subgroups. There's baseball lifer who's been around forever and is finally getting a chance. And then there's like baseball lifer who clearly is on his way to being a manager and isn't that old. But like, of course, he's interviewed for 100 different jobs and he finally got it. That was obviously Carlos Mendoza last year. And now I feel like Clayton McCullough kind of falls into that bucket.
We have heard Clayton McCullough's name in job openings for a long, long time. The specific fit here is interesting and shines a light on how jobs get filled. Now, I don't mean to oversimplify things here, but Peter Bendix, who is now the president of baseball operations for the Miami Marlins, came up in Tampa Bay and maintains a good relationship with Andrew Friedman, who was in Tampa Bay for a long time. Friedman had a strong relationship with Gabe Kapler. Kapler ended up in Miami. Friedman clearly knows McCullough well. McCullough ends up in Miami under Bendix. When you have someone like Bendix, who spent a lot of his career in one place in Tampa, the people that he knows within baseball are, and this is true with anybody, right? Like, the people that you know are the ones giving you recommendations on people. And I don't think it is a coincidence that he is going and plucking someone from the Andrew Friedman, Tampa Bay Dodger tree, if that makes sense.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And again, this is one where it feels like only a matter of time. On the MLB Trade Rumors write-up, just mentioning that he was in the mix for the Mets, the Brewers, Guardians, Royals. He was apparently a finalist for the Royals before they picked Matt Quatraro. And then even, I think his name was in talks with the White Sox as well. So, but I think that is a very good point about how do you kind of end up zeroing in on someone. But it's also not hard to be like, well, the Marlins were the last one to hire someone. That also tells me something. You know, this is no disrespect to Clayton McCullough whatsoever, but in terms of the processes and how quickly they fill these things, that's also not an irrelevant data point, I would say.
And it's not just that the Marlins took the longest to hire a manager. They knew that they were going to need a new manager, basically like on opening day.
Yeah, I was going to say, they've known the longest, and it took them the longest to fill it. So that can, you know, maybe speak to how this job was perceived. But at the end of the day, especially for someone who has been in the mix for these jobs for a long time, there are only 30 of these, right? And while it's not necessarily a matter of Clayton McCullough thinking, all right, I'm about to win the NL East in 2025, you can still make a pretty big difference. Like, you can prove that you are a good manager, as Skip, by the way, did very quickly, even amidst the chaos. You can do it if you're good. And so there will be serious challenges in Miami, as we know. I think roster-wise, it's not quite as desolate as the White Sox. There is certainly parts of this roster that you can look at and be like, oh, okay. However, this will be an uphill battle for a lot of reasons. But I'll be honest, you know what I'm looking forward to about this? Just knowing more about Clayton McCullough. This is one of the people, this is the other fun thing when you see these people that you hear their names, It is practically impossible to find like a video of Clayton McCullough being interviewed. Because those people, that part of the coaching staff, they're just always, even though they're on TV every night because of the first base coach, you don't hear from them. You don't understand them as personalities or as baseball minds. And so now he has to, because he talks to the media every day. And so that I'm looking forward to kind of getting to know him a little bit better.
I wish Clayton McCullough nothing but the best. Jordan, in talking to people around the game, the Marlins remain a punchline.
Yep.
And I hope that Clayton McCullough can work to change that. It is a real uphill battle, and time will tell. Mm-hmm. Next topic. The Phillies kind of shook up their front office. I think this is compelling and interesting. Now, obviously, the president of baseball operations, Dave Dombrowski, is the one who's truly in charge in Philadelphia. He's the top dog. Below him for the last number of years has been Sam Fold as the general manager. Sam Fold, former big league outfielder, really could go get it. Great defender in the outfield. Member of the Jewish community. Shouts out Sam Fold. Good dude. Like talking to Sam. Sam, however, Sam's going back to school. Sam said, I'm going to do some business. And he, what? What are you laughing at? He said, I'm going to do business.
You're right. It's just, this is so bizarre to see a team press release with the words, he will be leaving to pursue his degree at Wharton. It's like, what? Why? And then he will be returning to be the president of business operations. Where this, like, I read this, I was like, oh, Sam Fold doesn't love baseball anymore. he's like, you know what? I want to focus on the dollars and cents.
I will say this. Okay, so, and they're replacing Sam Fold as a GM with Preston Mattingly, who's the son of Don Mattingly. Okay.
What? They're related?
The number two. What?
Joking. I said, well, they're related. Sorry, continue.
They're related. Presti baseball. Whoever the number two is under Dombrowski is the number two. Let's be clear. Like, Sam Fold had a lot of say in the way that the team was built and the organization was run. Yeah, but like, Dombrowski is running the ball club. Okay. And so whoever that number two person is not pulling levers and pushing buttons, right? That being said, the headline, general manager of Philadelphia Phillies, like, vacates job, goes to business school, Like, that's kind of wonky, dude.
This is what I'm saying. Here's why I kind of like it, even though I'm sad that Sam Fold won't, like, be around to talk about baseball anymore, is, like, we've seen the reverse of this. Like, that's the normal. It's like, I work in business. I work in not baseball. But the dream is, of course, to be working in baseball. And Sam Fold, a former major leaguer, somehow, the whole time he was the GM of the Phillies, he was just had that itch of, like, nah, I really don't actually want to do less baseball.
He's like, I need to know about supply chain management, right? Like, there are really, so many dorks at Wharton who want to be GMs.
And look,
and
I know
Fold's going the other way.
I understand he majored in econ at Stanford. I get it. I know this is not like a newfound passion. It is just a very unique sequence of events.
Here is my best guess. Running the baseball team takes a lot more time and effort and energy and exhaustion than running the business side of a baseball team, especially when it comes to hours. And maybe Sam Fold just wants to kick it with his family.
That's
more
fine.
Often.
Of course. That's totally case, legit.
We love a
but
man
now
who
he
loves
has,
his
but
family.
Now he has homework to do.
Now he has homework to do. Now he has homework.
Does
to
he?
Do.
You're like in anyway, okay. So many other jokes can be made about that situation. Congratulations, Preston Mattingly. And Dave Dombrowski is still obviously running the show. Couple other bits of news. Zach Neto needs shoulder surgery. Uh-oh. We talked about some early moves that the Angels were making this offseason. Ooh, okay. What are they going to do? Are they going to be aggressive? Are they going to finally build this roster into a winner? Well, one of the only things that, like, we unquestionably felt great about, right? If you're saying, like, things about the Angels looking forward where you're like, yes, that is good. I like that. I would love for that to be a thing on my baseball team. Zach Neto is one of them. And unfortunately, apparently, during that just that fateful series at the end of the regular season with the White Sox that we were all laughing at, apparently Zach Neto injured his shoulder and needs shoulder surgery. So he might be starting missing the start of the season, which sucks because I love Zach Neto and any tiny chance that the Angels were going to be good next year is now even smaller because one of their best players needs shoulder surgery. That makes me sad. Here's another piece of news, Jake. It's not on our sheet, but I'm throwing it to you. Aaron Boone, still the manager of the Yankees. They have extended. They have exercised their option. Can you believe it?
Yeah,
I can believe it. Yeah.
No, exercise is important. It's important to exercise whenever you can. I went to the gym this morning. And I'm sure that's exactly how Hal Steinbrenner felt when he exercised the heck out of this option for Aaron Boone. Look, he took him to the World Series. You go to the World Series and you have an option as a manager, they're going to pick it up. It's not that complicated. If the Yankees flame out and suck eggs in 2025, we can all sit down in a circle and have a conversation about whether Aaron Boone should be the manager of the Yankees going forward. Now is not the time for that. They just went to the World Series.
Let's be honest. Let's be honest. We do that conversation every November, no matter what.
Sure. speaking of Yankees, our last topic in turbo mode, yes. Reggie Jackson. Reggie Jackson, the legendary slugger who played for the New York Yankees, I believe for less time than you think, only 5 years, but still walloped 144 home runs.
Pretty good pinstripe. 5 years. Yeah, he had a nice time there.
He had a good time there. He then worked for the Yankees for a long time after retiring from a player. And then, like, got fed up for being underused as, like, I believe he referred to himself once as a hood ornament. So he just bailed on the Yankees and went to go work for the Astros and was, like, making legitimate baseball operations decisions for the Astros for, like, 4 years. Like, with the owner, Jim Crane, and other Hall of Famers like Jeff Bagwell. And now he's not going to be doing that anymore. Just a great reminder that Reggie Jackson was working for the Astros.
Yeah.
Very, very odd.
That is still one of the stranger kind of, like, I'm sure he would just keep showing up when they were in the postseason and it'd be like, oh, there's, like, when they would play against the Yankees and it's like, there's Reggie Jackson talking Stros. It's like, oh, okay, sure.
I believe that that news was first reported by John Heyman and Joel Sherman of the New York Post. I apologize to John and Joel.
Come on,
don't
now.
Mean to slight them at all. Jordan, that's all we got for Turbo Mode. Before we get out of here, I'm going to introduce a new segment for you. And it is called One Dumb Question.
Just one?
And it's simple. I'm going to ask you one dumb question. I'm going to do this every Monday. I'm just going to ask you a stupid question, okay?
I guess, yeah, I'm ready.
This was posed to me by my lovely sister.
So it's her dumb question. You're forwarding the dumb question. You did not. All right, so your sister. All right, got it. Kind of throwing her under the bus as being dumb, but go ahead.
What if the batter and the pitcher were on the same team?
I mean, that does happen. It's called the home run derby.
What if for one inning a game, you could have the pitcher be on your team?
Now, am I putting the pitcher out there, or is the pitcher that is employed by the other team now just have to listen to what I am telling them to do?
For one inning, every game, you get to choose an employee of yours to walk out to the mound and throw freaking meatballs to your hitters.
Well, what if? Yeah, man, I don't know.
I guess
the question is, when would you do it? I think if we're really trying to dig into this, like, would you basically? I mean, the first thing is you'd obviously just have a position player do this. There's no reason you would have an actual pitcher do this. But if you were to throw your bench guy out there and say, "Hey, give me BP for an inning," would you just do it off the rip and try to score as many runs as you can? Or would you? But by the way, they're still playing defense. It's just the pitcher.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I maintain the question. I throw it back at you. When would you want to do it? Would you wait until you were down?
The ninth?
I don't know.
All right, high leverage might be spot. Lost
by then. right. It's like, oh, here comes the never mind, not the closer. It's my turn to do
I think
it.
Teams would put a lot more emphasis on their defense if once the game you had to, you know, it was getting clocked around the diamond.
Yeah, but you know, if you're doing it well, the ball's going over the fence.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of, there's only so much you would be able to combat it, I would say.
But it was a really interesting thought process for me because, you know, our whole lives, you think of the batter and the hitter as these forces in opposition to one another. But the idea that they could be cooperating, you're right, it is like the home run derby. But
that's what it is.
Copy and pasting that relationship into a game where you're trying to score runs, I would like to see this style of baseball played. I'm going to see if my Little League kids can
do
this.
I am compelled by, like, how would the defense set up if they knew that the pitcher was, you know, because sure, you see position players pitching sometimes, but at that point they don't care, right? The defense doesn't care either. But in this scenario, the defense is still like desperately trying to record the out. And in that scenario, like, I'm curious, how would you just have whatever six outfielders? I don't know. And trust that the hitters will not be able to resist trying to hit it over the fence and just hope that they fly out. I don't know. These are important questions. Is your sister going to listen to this and hear it or not? This is all for naught because it's really just for her. Okay. Hi, Abby. That's it. Baseball Barbacast is over. Thank you to Yuri for joining us again. Cannot recommend his work enough. It is so, 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 so useful. And I learned stuff. His YouTube channel is just an incredible resource. And we really appreciate him giving us some time all the way over outside of Tokyo. So, of course, we made the time zones work. That's why we're recording here late on Sunday night. But we'll be back later this week on Wednesday. The offseason rolls on. I believe we have our qualifying offer deadline coming up later this week. So we'll maybe have some news later on. But other than that, thank you all for listening. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz, as always. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for doing this podcast with me. And we will talk to you all on Wednesday. Bye-bye.